planet schemes. Jiggle on and Jiggleette wake up to find their eyes are wet with tears that tell of broken dreams. Here is where you'll always find me, always walking up and down. But I left my soul behind me in an old cathedral town.
Tony Bennett singing The Boulevard of Broken Dreams. He died on Friday at the age of 96. He was a funder of the civil rights movement and marched with Dr. Martin Luther King. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to an historic settlement for more than 1,300 people who were attacked by New York City police while protesting the police murder of George Floyd in 2020. The landmark $13 million settlement announced last week with the City of New York is years in the making and is the largest total payout to protest in a class action suit in U.S. history, with each person receiving just under $10,000. The case focused on how police violated protesters' civil and constitutional rights by making mass arrests using excessive force that included improper use of pepper spray, using a tactic called kettling to trap and arrest protesters before a curfew went into effect. This is footage about improper arrests used in the case from an officer's body camera. Camera off, the police are saying. This settlement's the latest in a series of legal victories for protesters that use a video analysis tool developed by Situ Research that quickly analyzes massive amounts of police body camera videos, aerial footage, and social media videos. The City of New York settled another lawsuit in March with more than 300 protesters in the Mott Haven neighborhood of the Bronx over the NYPD's use of kettling in 2020 protests. Each person received about $21,000, the highest per person settlement for a mass arrest in U.S. history. While this latest settlement did not impose any reforms on the NYPD, the director at Situ Research told The Intercept, quote, our larger goal remains enduring change in policing. For more, we're joined by two guests. Gideon Oliver is a civil rights attorney, co-counsel for the plaintiffs in the case, and Dara Pluchino is a named plaintiff in the case who was also a class member for the Mott Haven settlement. She's a social worker. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Gideon Oliver, let's just talk about the scope of this settlement and the significance of the New York City, I mean, the taxpayers, having to pay out $13 million because of police misconduct and brutality.
Thank you so much, Amy. It's a great pleasure to be back on the show, and it was a great pleasure to litigate this case with National Lawyers Guild lawyers from Cohen and Green, Beldock, Levine and Hoffman, and Wiley Stecklow. You know, although there's no technical admission of liability from the city or the police department in connection with the settlement, the size of the settlement really speaks for itself. And although it's historic, as you just mentioned, there was recently another historic settlement. And, you know, a number of times before, the city of New York has paid out historic settlements or judgments in protester cases. And so it really begs the question, you know, what's going to change? What's going to be different this time?
So, Dara Pluchino, tell us what happened to you in these Black Lives Matter protests in 2020. This, remember, folks, was in the midst of the pandemic. Just the bravery alone of people coming out in force, thousands of people in city after city protesting the police murder of George Floyd.
Yes, thank you, Amy, so much for having us today and covering this. I can speak about my experience and also recognize that my experience, largely due to the identities I hold and how that protects me from policing's violence, is not representative of what I witnessed happen to many others in protest that summer and since and before. And so it's really essential that this not be considered as an isolated summer or an isolated incident. And my experience was one of unlawful policing, was one of kettling in Mott Haven and then mass arrest, being held for much longer than allowed, being handed off from the arresting officer to the one who wrote the citation. I have lasting nerve damage in my left hand from the use of the zip tie handcuffs. And my experience is also much safer. I was much less harmed and my body was treated with much more care during arrest than folks around me who presented as black and brown and who I witnessed being hit with batons while arrested and handcuffed face down on the ground, who I witnessed get pepper sprayed in a targeted way, who I witnessed be punched, and etc.
I want to turn to video accompanying the 2020 protest that was produced by Human Rights Watch and Situ Research about the NYPD's plan to kettle and arrest protesters June 4th, 2020, again, right after Floyd's murder. In this clip, you hear an exchange between a New York police officer and two protesters.
The protesters had already been forced to break the curfew, and the police keep ratcheting up the pressure.
Hey, you guys are on the other side! You guys are on the other side! Where do we go?
How do we go? Where are we going to go? We're corralled!
Jail!
Dara, they're saying, you guys are there. We can't go anywhere. You've corralled us in. If you can also explain for people who aren't familiar with what kettling is, describe it in detail.
Yes, kettling is the practice of enclosing a group of people, in this case protesters, in a small area so that there is not the ability to leave that area once mass arrest is going to occur. And in the case of these protests, the kettling occurred, as the person in the video shared, prior to when the curfew was in place. And so it was a small, narrow street. And what occurred was that the group of protesters marching came upon a line of police officers using bikes and batons and their bodies as a barrier in the front of the crowd. And then when the end of the group of protesters was on that same street, another line of police came behind to do the same and serve as a barrier with their bikes and batons and bodies. And at that point, the group of protesters was stuck and unable to leave that block radius because we were surrounded by homes and buildings on either side and then police lines in the front and the back. And once the curfew hit, then that is when chaos occurred.
Gideon,
and violence occurred.
Gideon Oliver, just last week, Gothamist reported that NYPD officers accused of wrongdoing can now watch all relevant video of an incident before speaking to investigators. Video evidence played a huge role in this settlement. If you can first talk about this in situ, the video compiling massive amounts of video from police body cam and from social media, how this helped with this settlement, and then talk about what that means for police being able to view this before for the future.
Sure. So, I mean, in this case, we both received and gathered an unprecedented amount of video from many sources, but including a huge number of NYPD body-worn camera, pieces of NYPD body-worn camera footage, NYPD aerial surveillance footage, et cetera. And working with Situ Research, the partner who also worked with Human Rights Watch on the video clip that you just played, Situ Research was able to organize that data in a way that they and we, the plaintiff's attorneys, could essentially look at what happened in a given date and location, integrating those various different video sources, which was just an incredible resource to be able to have. And in terms of the CCRB's new policy or change policy, you know, before the new policy, a NYPD member could view their body-worn camera footage or other body-worn camera footage because they can access that footage through a central repository, but they wouldn't. But if they did so, there would be a record, right? There would be a record and an audit trail or metadata. And so that's a data point that an investigator or somebody thinking about the officer's credibility could use in evaluating their statement to the CCRB. Police didn't have access to other footage, non-body-worn camera footage, Teru footage taken by other police, aerial footage taken by other police, et cetera. Now the CCRB has changed its policy and is going to allow NYPD members to view basically all of the footage before giving statements. And that's not something, by the way, that's going to happen for victims and witnesses. So this is a change that's going to really undermine the truth-seeking process that the CCRB is supposed to be involved in. It's outrageous. It's going to lead to much less justice and accountability. And it's also interesting because the CCRB investigated many incidents of uses of force arising from the summer 2020 protests. And one of its chief complaints to the police department was that the police department wasn't making video footage and other evidence available to it, and that in many cases, NYPD members who, according to policy, should have had their body-worn cameras activated in interacting with protesters were ordered by supervisors to turn the cameras off.
I want to put this last question to each of you, and the issue of this being a money settlement, about 1,300 people getting just under 10,000 each, as opposed to also being a policy-changing settlement. Let me first ask Gideon, then Dara, as we wrap up.
You know, what this massive settlement means for New Yorkers is an open question, right? And it's we can't rely on the city government to do what they're supposed to do, which is translate a huge settlement like this into some kind of increased accountability, oversight, and policy change. So, you know, the settlement is historic and incredibly important, but it's also in some ways only as important as what we make it mean. So that's how I am.
And Dara Pulcino, you were part of both settlements, both in Mott Haven and this historic $13 million settlement.
Yes, I think I would echo a lot of what Gideon shared, and I would add here that it's also an opportunity for folks like myself, where this is representative of a more isolated incident with police because of the racist practices of policing, to redistribute and reinvest in local community organizations and individuals and the people who are in community doing the daily work of keeping them safe outside of policing, which we know does not serve the role that it is espoused to.
Well, I want to thank you.
And for others, I hope what this money will do is provide an opportunity to access rest and care and therapy or, you know, whatever form that takes, be it a vacation, be it a nice meal out with friends, be it formal talk therapy, but whatever kind of care and healing is required from these incidents and also the daily experience of living and existing in an over-policed community and city and state and country.
Dara Pulcino, social worker, plaintiff in this case, and Gideon Oliver, civil rights attorney, co-counsel for the plaintiffs in this historic settlement. Coming up, we look at the new blockbuster film about J. Robert Oppenheimer. We'll speak to journalist Greg Mitchell. He asks, is Hollywood still afraid of the truth about the atomic bomb? Back in 30 seconds. Destroyer of Worlds by Ludwig Aronson, from the soundtrack of the movie Oppenheimer. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show at the movies. Amidst the ongoing SAG-AFTRA strike, Universal Pictures canceled the red carpet for the U.S. premiere of Christopher Nolan's Oppenheimer. Meanwhile, people filled theaters this weekend to see the film about J. Robert Oppenheimer, all known as the father of the atomic bomb. This is the trailer.
Imagine a future. And our imaginings horrify us. They won't fear it. Until they understand it. And they won't understand it. Until they've used it. Theory will take you only so far. I don't know if we can be trusted with such a weapon. But we have no choice.
The physicist J. Robert Oppenheimer developed and tested the world's first atomic bomb in New Mexico. In that state, the film is being preceded by a 15-second advertisement produced by the Union of Concerned Scientists that notes, quote, Oppenheimer's bomb led to decades of nuclear testing across the Southwest. Communities still suffer health impacts related to the tests, many without government recognition or justice. For more, we're joined by Greg Mitchell, documentary filmmaker, author of numerous books about this very topic, including The Beginning or the End, How Hollywood and America Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. He was editor of Nuclear Times magazine in the 1980s. He's written about this new film for Mother Jones on his Substack and an opinion piece for the LA Times headlined Oppenheimer is Here. Is Hollywood still afraid of the truth about the atomic bomb? Greg, welcome back to Democracy Now! Some are calling this the greatest anti-nuclear film ever. You have a different and a critical perspective on the film. Why don't you just talk about your response to the film, what it got right, what it got wrong?
Yes. I saw an early screening of the film before a lot of the critical opinions came in, so I saw it with a very open mind. And I think people should see the film. I think it's very well written, well acted, well directed, and I think it probably has good intentions. So I would certainly encourage people to see it. However, I did find a number of issues with it, which I've written about really every day on my blog and newsletter. And it's not so much what's shown in the movie. The movie does end up and wants to warn people about future dangers and future threats of the bomb, which is, you know, which is admirable. And I'm not sure any director besides Christopher Nolan, with a long track record of popularity, would have or could have had this film made. However, the omissions are quite serious. You already mentioned one, which is really the lack, almost the total lack of any mentions or exploration of the radiation, revolutionary new radiation effects of this weapon, both in the Trinity test, which is one of the main focuses of the film, showing the Trinity test. It does not show the radioactive cloud that drifted away and the fallout that affected people, and then, of course, as you mentioned, the decades of nuclear tests, exposure to soldiers and workers and so forth. So that's one thing. Another thing is that it does not show any images of people on the ground in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. There's nothing. We see Oppenheimer watching a screen where it sounds like the footage is being aired or screened. We do not see any of those images. We just see him growing a little bit disturbed about it. they do not, in the same time, they do not mention that 85% of the victims in Hiroshima and Nagasaki were civilians. They don't mention that at all. And another thing, they barely mention Nagasaki. It's kind of thrown in passing in the last part of the film. It's just kind of tossed in as if it was kind of forced into the script. And for my mind, one of the most important things is certainly it does not challenge in any way the Hiroshima narrative or official narrative, as I call it, that has held sway since 1945. About the decision to use the bomb. Well, you know, we can talk about that more. It's very important and the legacy for today. Instead, I think when people say it's an anti-nuclear film, you know, there is the message of dangers for today and control of the weapons and so forth, but it does not challenge the use of the bomb in 1945. I think you're supposed to take away from the haunted visage of Oppenheimer and the great actor Cillian Murphy, his sort of vague, conflicted, confusing regrets that he seemed to issue during the movie and during his life. But in fact, you know, as I've shown at my blog and in my books, Oppenheimer, in fact, defended the use of the bomb against Japan to the end of his life, right up to 1965, 1966. So the film is a little misleading in that. But in fact, it's true and it's quite accurate that Oppenheimer really did not reject it. And the film certainly does not challenge the decision to use the bomb. It's more moving forward from 1945.
So when you talk about Hiroshima and Nagasaki, in fact, the footage that came out, that these scientists were shown at Los Alamos afterwards, the horror of the skin melted. There's one reference to it, you know, an image of it.
An image, yeah.
But the actual film was classified for years. Is that right, Greg?
Yeah, well, yeah, I've written a whole book called Atomic Cover-Up about it, and I directed a film 2 years ago that got quite a bit of attention, including on this show, called Atomic Cover-Up, which looked at the post, you know, the post-Hiroshima Nagasaki complete suppression of both Japanese footage and the U.S. color footage that was seized and suppressed for many decades. So, of course, we don't see that in the film. I wouldn't necessarily expect that. But, you know, the decision to use the bomb in the film is handled. I mean, there is an accurate scene which shows at the end of May of 1945, the interim committee, which was Truman's leading advisory committee on this, had a meeting where the subject sort of briefly came up, how to use the bomb and should they use it. Oppenheimer, as he did in real life, shot this down and said this was, you know, couldn't work or wouldn't work. It was the wrong idea to do a demonstration shot. You know, the bomb had to be used. And then one of the other members of the committee then gives a ringing explanation, which became the Hiroshima narrative that still carries the day today, you might say, with the media and some historians, which is that, you know, only the use of the bomb, only the use of two bombs really would prevent a bloody invasion of Japan, hundreds of thousands of U.S. casualties and so forth. And this is not really challenged in the film, and not by Oppenheimer, not really in the film narrative. It then goes to the future, and Hiroshima and Nagasaki are kind of left alone. And, you know, the danger of this and the legacy and the reason I've written so much on this for the past 40 years, really, is that the lessons for today is that, yes, everyone says we should never use nuclear weapons again. It's terrible. They must not be used. But on the other hand, we make these two exceptions from 1945 of Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
For people,
and we have a. And we have a yeah, go on.
For people to understand, Greg, I mean, these scientists that came together at Los Alamos, the secret community that was built for them to build the atomic bomb, were motivated by taking on Nazi Germany. But then Nazi Germany surrenders, right? Or is beaten, is defeated. So if you can explain further, because this is something you're so steeped in, what it meant then to decide to use this bomb on Japan and also where the Soviet Union came into this, where Russia came into this.
Right. Right. Yeah, of course, the motivation for making the bomb was largely Hitler and Nazi Germany. Of course, many of the top physicists were refugee Jewish scientists, physicists from Germany. And it's really the main reason we beat Hitler to the bomb. Germany surrendered, and we were still fighting Japan, of course, very, very bloody battles and bombing their cities that spring into the summer. So, of course, then the target became Japan and the focus. And there were scientists such as Leo Szilard who did circulate a petition that asked people to ask other scientists to sign this petition that would go to Truman that would ask them to not use the bomb or delay, at least delay using the bomb. Oppenheimer was one of those people who squelched that petition, incidentally. Basically, the decision was made that we, even though an invasion of Japan was not scheduled till November and December, that we had to use this bomb, or we wanted to use this bomb as soon as possible. And so we had the Trinity test, and then we had the dropping of the bomb in early August. You mentioned the Soviet aspect of it, and it's very important because we, at our urgings, insistence, Stalin agreed to enter the war in by mid-August, and yet we went ahead and dropped the bomb before the Soviets entered the war. Some people say that the Soviet entry, along with a couple other negotiating things, could have ended the war pretty much in the same time frame that it ended. Truman himself, as I'm sure you're aware, wrote in his diary, "Finny Japs," when the Soviets would enter the war. General Eisenhower later said it was totally unnecessary to use the bomb, that Japan was going to surrender very soon. And, you know, you have to step back a bit, which the film doesn't do the best job of showing, okay, you deliberately targeted and exploded these bombs over the center of two cities. That was the aim. Oppenheimer was in on that. Everyone knew in the targeting committee that the aim was to really to kill as many people and cause as much destruction as possible, which they executed. This was not a surprise. So you really have to go back and say, was it worth, especially to the people, of course, who died, and the lessons for today, where we still have a first strike policy today, that we can use nuclear weapons in response to a crisis or conventional attack. And the lesson that we have from Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which is still endorsed by the media every year and many historians, is you can make exceptions and decide to use these weapons, because we not only use them against two cities, but we continue, or many people continue, to defend that today.
Finally, we're going to do a post-show, part two of this conversation, but I wanted to read a tweet to give people a sense of what we're going to talk about, from the author and journalist Alyssa Lynn Valdez, who wrote this quote from the New York Times review of Oppenheimer film. "He served as director of a clandestine weapons lab built in a near-desolate stretch of Los Alamos in New Mexico." She notes, "It was inhabited by Hispanos. They were given less than 24 hours to leave, their farms bulldozed. We have 15 seconds to give us a sense of what we'll talk about in part two."
Well, there were a lot of secrecy aspects to Los Alamos. That's a lot to go into there. But the legacy of Los Alamos was a lot of these radiation effects and secrecy, the secrecy regime that really held sway in the U.S. for decades after, really right to this day.
Well, Greg Mitchell, we want to thank you for being with us. We're going to link to your new piece for the Los Angeles Times. Oppenheimer's here. Is Hollywood still afraid of the truth about the atomic bomb? And we'll do part two at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of Canada Land, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week, I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.